LinkedIn tells me that you are on sabbatical right now. So I feel doubly honored that you've made time for this. You've talked about the early years of Client Earth, and it strikes me that your transition from law school in New York, working on Wall Street in the early days, to founding Client Earth nearly 18 years ago, it strikes me as an atypical path. And I wondered if there was a pivotal moment that inspired you, actually, as you put it in your book, to use the power of law for the planet. If there was one thing, or was it a gradual realization?
No, it was pretty early on. Actually, I had thought that I might become a scientist because I've always been like most kids are in love with the natural world if they have any connection with it, right? It's a natural thing. And I fell deeply in love with the natural world, and I never stopped being in love with the natural world. So after university and during university, I was wondering, how do I take care of it? And that was before we knew it was getting to be in such bad shape. So I became a lawyer with the idea of doing something useful, but there was very little environmental law back in those days. I started working with an early group called the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, and kind of helped create the early environmental law movement, and felt very good doing that because I was then somebody who could say that the earth was their client. And not many lawyers do. I had worked on Wall Street for a little bit before that, because that's sort of what you do. But I came to the point where going to the office every day, I could barely breathe because it wasn't exactly my world. And to put it very much in a more of an understated way than even British people use understatement, it wasn't my world. So I was thrilled to get out and then be able to work for the environment. Then I did a couple of other things before starting Client Earth, actually, though. So for 7 years, so I've been meditating for a very long time. And I started an organization after setting up an LA office for this environmental law group, NRDC. I then I took a year off, and it was a retreat year. And then when I came back, the Dalai Lama and my other spiritual teachers had asked me to set up something to help social activists and environmentalists learn how to meditate so they wouldn't burn out. So I actually did that for 7 years, and that was really interesting. And then a group of neuroscientists who wanted to work with hallucinogens and psychedelics came to me and said, well, you seem to be a lawyer who could do anything. You know, could you make it legal for us to work with these things? So I did that for 7 years, and that was part of the foundation of what's now a very rich, you read about in the papers every day, people are coming up with different kinds of therapies based on hallucinogens, and that work was the foundational work there. And then love took me to England, and we moved to London and found that there wasn't any environmental law to speak of going on really in Europe. And I wanted to get back to doing that. So that was the foundation of Client Earth. It was coming into this this new culture for me, reasonably new culture for me, and with this idea of maybe law for the environment would make sense in the UK and Europe. Mm. And it took off so quickly that it then became global, and now there are offices around the world. So these 300 people aren't all in Europe now. They're to bring this power of the law, as you mentioned, to the environmental movement, because the idea really was the activists' work is very important, indigenous people's work very important, communications work very important. But when that's all put together with law as well, then all of the ideas that you're working for are ones that can be turned into rules, and then rules that you can enforce. So you can get people who don't want to behave, which honestly, it's a lot of fun. Yeah,
you're clearly a prolific writer, a deep thinker, and there's a line from your new book, Nature, My Teacher, so out next month, that made me wonder how you navigate the intersections of the different worlds that you inhabit. And it is the opening line to an essay called Some People. It's about halfway through, and the first line made me chuckle. You wrote, "I love all living things, though there are some people I just can't like." Now, I absolutely can concur. And it also strikes me as the Philistine layperson that I am, that one of the things that Buddhism addresses is this absurd and very human longing for resolution, for permanence, in a universe that is in constant motion. And yet it also strikes me, as someone who knows very little about law, that law is all about resolution and permanence. I learned this afternoon that the word law comes from the old Norse word lag, which means something laid down or fixed. So I guess my rambling half-baked question is around how you navigate that balance between sort of compassionate contemplation and action.
I see law as a set of rules that are evolving. You work to get a law, to create a law. For example, one that Planet Earth worked on a lot was a very new law in the European Union that will prevent the EU from importing products that harm forests. So you're going to have to certify if you import cocoa or coffee or beef or soy into the EU. You're going to have to be able to show that it hasn't led to deforestation. Now, that's a really cool law, and if enforced, will have a huge impact on protecting forests. But it's a very new concept, and that's not a law that you can even imagine getting through 10 years ago. So for me, law is also a dynamic system, and it sort of captures a picture of how the society, any society, sees itself at a moment in time. Mm-hmm. So here we had the EU have really quite an enlightened perspective on this. That may change. In June, there are going to be elections for members of the parliament. It looks like it might go more conservative. So that law came through last year. Would it be passed 2 years from now? I don't know. But it's a picture of a moment in which the EU had a very enlightened view of these things. And that makes it semi-permanent, you know, so it will continue evolving and hopefully get better rather than worse, although that can also happen. So law I see as an evolving thing. It's clear and definite at any moment. So you can say, you're breaking this rule. Donald Trump is a fraud, you know, because that is quite clear at that time, but that can evolve. So, and then how do I deal with contemplative? The world is in danger, certainly. My book is a lot about that. I'm very, very honest about my own anxiety about that. When I was CEO of this global organization, I actually didn't feel like I could talk easily about my personal anxiety because I had to keep the ship moving, you know? Mm. But now that I'm not the CEO, but the fancy title is founder and president, which sort of means I can play a lot more, and I thought I can be personal now. And I can talk about the anxiety that underlays and motivates the work, but also that you have to keep dealing with. So if you really focus on climate and the loss of nature, it takes you very quickly to a place of anxiety. And there are now all kinds of very good studies showing that people around the world, particularly young people all over the world, are really experiencing anxiety about the future. And it's based on what we're doing to the climate and what we're doing to nature. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, a lot of anxiety is irrational. Lots of anxiety is irrational. Climate anxiety is rational. It's a rational response to a real thing. So how do you deal with it? The way I deal with it, for me, the meditation practice gives you a safe space. So you can actually calm down and the mind stops worrying around, you know, and calms. And then you can study how you feel and you can be with how you're feeling. And by being with it, that transforms it. So that it's not something you're afraid of anymore, but you recognize that anxiety almost as a friend, but as a companion, which you can learn from and work with, and that gives you energy. So then you use that energy to try and do something good. And for me, the anxiety is much alleviated by doing anything positive, by trying to do something positive and seeing positive results. It doesn't end it, as the book discusses, but it allows you to deal with it and, you know, and allows you to have a very positive take on life rather than negative. I'm a very optimistic person. And even after everything I know about climate and nature loss, because there are things we can do, and I feel like I'm doing some of them and working together with others who, not just me, but many, many others who then can do a great deal more.
One of the things that struck me about the book is your honesty in talking about the toll this work has taken on you personally, you know, emotionally, physically, psychologically. You write with extraordinary honesty about the anxiety, sleepless nights, about the, I love, you talk more than once about the donkey, you know, the donkey being overwhelmed and triggered and needing pasture. I love that expression. And I guess beyond, you've talked about the importance of meditation and the value that that's given you. Beyond that, I guess my question is, how have you learned to look after the donkey and what advice can you give people like me who might be haunted by the fact that they are at least halfway, if not more, through their allotted time on this mortal coil, with a feeling of you know, there is so much left to do. I'm not one that as my wife will tell you, to whom, you know, taking time off comes that naturally. So how do I look after the donkey? How have you learned to do that?
I like this concept of the donkey needs pasture. You know, sometimes. Mm. And it's honestly been really difficult for me to take time off because I do know what's going on. And I did tend to work 7 days a week. For a long time, I thought holidays were kind of an annoyance because there was so much to do. And now looking back on that, I realize I actually would have had greater resilience and endurance to actually take care of the donkey a little bit more. So to the degree that you take care of the donkey can ride further, you know, and also be in a better mood rather than tired or angry all the time, right? So it's a constant process. If you see the need to do stuff, you know, you have to remind yourself. You have to remind yourself. And for me, nature does call me, and that helps. As other things might call to other people, nature really calls to me, and I feel very good when I'm in any natural setting. In London, we have a park that we can walk in, and that doesn't. You know, it's by the Lee River and the Lee Valley and in East London. And it's live enough and lively enough so that I get that. And I write something about that in the book, actually. Or wilderness. You know, it doesn't actually, wilderness is unbelievable, you know, but it doesn't always have to be wilderness. It's that connection with nature. And that does draw me out. And then, you know, that it's now well understood by neuroscientists that when you're in connection with nature, it actually helps you stop. The worst danger is the repetitive stuff, you know, the repeated, I must do this or I must do that. You know, I've got to get this done or whatever form of repetitious stuff is going on, which drags you down. And the connection with nature tends to break that quite naturally. And it does, I experience that. And it's because nature is unpredictable. You know, the shapes of trees aren't like we draw them, you know, they're multidimensional. You know, a bird will fly across, or, you know, a dog will run across the path. All of this stuff is immediately breaks you out of the endless repetitive tiring stuff we do in our mind. So for me, the reason I say nature my teacher is that it never stops. The more time I'm in nature, the better I feel.
I want to go back to Client Earth. You described a law earlier as cool, which I thought was wonderful. And I was going to ask if there was a case that you were proudest of.
I'll give you two, actually, one in Europe and one in America. So in Europe, a lot of the airlines are greenwashing, you know, and the KLM, the Dutch carrier, was particularly bad. I mean, it was basically saying you can fly as much as you want with us forever. And you don't have to worry about carbon because everything is beautifully offset and, you know, fly more. And, you know, it was all just nonsense. I mean, it was, that's to put it kindly, you know, and so we sued them and with some Dutch environmental groups, and we just won last week. So that's the first time that anyone's ever sued an airline on any climate issue, certainly on greenwashing. And it was a really clear victory. The court gave us every one of our arguments. So that sends a big message. Greenwashing is an increasing problem as companies claim that they're doing good things when they're not. So I like that one a lot because it's the globally first case against an airline for climate. And then we just brought one here a few weeks ago by the American team of the newest office, which is one of the newest offices. Tokyo is another, but I'm here to help build this up. And a brilliant young team. And they discovered this problem that I didn't know existed. Oil and gas wells are drilled, and then at the end of their life, they're supposed to be capped. You know, and that ends the leakage of methane. The turns out there are more than 2 million of them that aren't kept in the United States. And then they looked into it more, and it's fraud. So it starts with big oil companies, and they extract a lot, and then they turn it over to an intermediary company, sell it to an intermediary company, who sells it to a company that's designed to go bankrupt, which means that by the time the well needs to be plugged, the bankrupt company can say, oh, sorry, you know, we can't afford to do that. So the government's taxpayers are going to have to do that. And it's a knowing fraud. Mm. You know, it's because this is the way things are done. And the big oil company never puts, it costs only $100,000 to you know, cap one of these wells. Mm. And that should be on their books with the value of the well, you know, the liability and the asset. And it isn't. They only put the asset on. Now, since this is over 2 million wells and they cost $100,000 each, that's $200 billion in ill-gotten gains that the oil companies made from the taxpayers. It's like, wow, when is enough for these people, right? So they very cleverly, this team, figured all that out. And we've sued on behalf of some landowners in Colorado, sued the intermediary company, claiming that it's fraud. Since and it's a tort, you know, and there's a conspiracy to defraud. So we've actually sued on conspiracy. And it's a beautiful one because it's not even an environmental case. So that people who aren't so crazy about environmentalists might actually get it, you know. So for all I know, these landowners may be Republicans. One of the ladies who's a plaintiff, you know, her house apparently is full of taxidermied animals, you know, so she's probably not a member of Greenpeace.
A decent gun collection in the cellar, no doubt.
I would hope so.
Gosh.
What I like about that is here we're trying to protect the climate and people's health. And what the team has done is to find a way to do it by using these financial tools. But it doesn't even raise barriers of is it environmental or whatever. You know, it's just, this is just wrong. I mean, it's just bad, you know. Mm. People are being lied to and taxpayers are being stolen from. So those are two cases that I particularly like, and they're very much live for me, right?
Gosh. And I mean, fascinating, particularly the latter one. And I'm now, one again, my sort of layman's brain is sort of whirring away, trying to figure out how on earth this all comes together. And do these sorts of cases come from, I assume you might have sort of researchers on the team in-house, or do they come from, I don't know, some sort of a kind of whistleblower typically, or is there no rhyme or reason to it?
Well, they come in different ways. The facts behind this case in Colorado were dug up by one of our partner organizations. We work with about 300 other NGOs called Carbon Tracker in this case. And Carbon Tracker is a great British NGO that looks at all the facts in the oil and gas industry. And one of our lawyers put that together with the law and figured out, oh, wow, you know, this is happening in plain sight and nobody's paying any attention. So that's a lot of work to put all those facts together and then to take the facts that Carbon Tracker had and to turn it into a case, huge amount. But, you know, there are some that are very simple. So the head of our Japanese office was able to write to a power company and who wanted to build a coal plant and say, we can prove that in Japan, it's actually bad business to build a coal plant now because renewable energy will be cheaper. So if you go ahead, we're going to have to sue you and we'll win because we did a case like that in Europe and we won. And within a week, they had decided not to build a coal plant. So there you get a really cool thing where you've built momentum in one part of the world and demonstrated something, in this case in Poland, and then you're able in another part of the world to say, hold on, you know, we did it over there. This is simply a bad idea. And then there are other things that aren't cases that I'm very proud of, like about coal. Coal is one of the worst things you could possibly be involved in if you want to save the climate. And we've built up a really deep relationship with the Chinese over the last 10 years, training judges and training prosecutors to bring environmental.
I mean, I wanted to ask you if you were able to talk about that, if that was still ongoing. So, thank you.
Oh, sure. No, let's surprise people then, because this it's really not known in the West. And, you know, it's to me, it's unfortunate that on both sides, you have now propaganda and quite a lot of propaganda and hostility, which makes it much harder to have any reasonable relationship, you know, for for decades and decades, the American attitude towards China was both competition and cooperation, and not hostility. But China, what people in the West don't know, is genuinely concerned about climate change and nature loss, pollution of air, pollution of water, pollution of soil in China. And they're very, very eager to clean it up. And they're working very hard to clean it up. So I got invited by the Supreme Court of China to come to Beijing and help them write a law to allow citizen groups to sue polluters in China, including polluting companies owned by the government. So quite a remarkable change. And I helped them write that law. And that led to them asking Planet Earth to help train the judges in China to decide environmental cases, because they made, and nowhere else in the world, they wanted to move on the environment fast. So they made 3,000 environment court judges. There are no environment court judges in Britain. There are, I think, a couple in Sweden, but nowhere else in Europe, and a couple in Australia, maybe a couple in India, but almost nowhere in the world, none in America. So 3,000 judges who were just there to do environmental cases. And then the prosecutors came to us and said, you know, could you train us to bring environmental cases so that we can change everything really fast? So we brought in, you know, experts from all over the world to train the prosecutors and the judges. And now, this is like 5 years ago, the prosecutors have initiated over 400,000 cases. Imagine that. I mean, here you have a country which was very polluted, in which there were laws, but nobody was enforcing them. And then suddenly, after 5 years of effort, 400,000 cases. I mean, it's a massive rapid change. Really, really, really impressive, you know, what they're doing. And they really get it, that that they have a long-term view, and they talk about wanting to have healthy Chinese people there in 2,000 years. And you think, wow, that's the way we should be thinking in London and Washington.
Yeah, I've not heard that in recent sort of political campaigning rhetoric here in the UK.
Rishi Sunak frequently talks about, you know, the 2,000 years. No, of course we don't. It's not typical in the West, but shouldn't we be thinking that way? Cool thing about the environment in this regard is that the environment in this world where there's a lot of confrontation between the West and China, the environment is a sweet spot.
How do you think we got to this? You know, people suing governments on things that are critical issues.
I think it's actually quite simple. It's all about power. So, you know, that even when there's a good law, and governments pass good laws that are well-intentioned to on air pollution or climate, whatever it may be, then what happens? You know, people have the fantasy that law is sort of self-executing, that you write a law and then everything happens. It doesn't. So you write a law, and that's just a set of rules. And then the question is, what do people actually do? So you write the law is passed, and then the industry affected by it, which doesn't want to comply with the laws, comes in and has lots and lots and lots of lobbyists with lots and lots of money pushing the government in one direction. Every government, everywhere, no matter whether it's a good and well-intentioned government or a less well-intentioned government. But it's the same deal. The industries don't want to do it. They don't want to change. They've been making money in a certain way. The German car companies went nuts when we sued them, essentially sued them over air pollution, got orders against them on diesel, because even though diesel is killing a lot of people, they were making a lot of money out of diesel engines. They wanted to keep doing it until they were forced to stop. It's all about forcing people to do stuff they should be doing. The law may require that, but they'll push back, and it's a big force pushing government. So citizens have to come in on the other side and say, sorry, the rules of the game require you to play this way. We've already got the rules of the game. And who's going to do that? You know, I'm just saying it doesn't get you there. So citizens have to stand up and use the law to require governments and companies to do the right thing. Because the companies have so much pressure, governments are caught in it, and you need to push back. And when you do push back and win these significant victories, amazing things can happen. You know, and one of the things I discovered by doing this work is that, you know, there are lots of good people in the government. So the government, say a government isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. Well, there are a lot of good people in the government who want to. So if you sue and you've got a good lawsuit, you're actually empowering the good people in the government who want to do the right thing. Because then they go to the whoever else it is, like the elected people, and say, well, hey, you know, you may not want to do this, and Trouble is, we have to now. We've been sued. So the pressure that citizens can use by using the law levels the playing field with the very, very powerful industrial interests.
With your crystal ball, are there any emerging legal or environmental issues or both that you think will become the next sort of significant battlefield for you guys?
About 7 or 8 years ago, we looked around and we said, if all the environmental laws in the world were enforced, would that take care of the environment enough? And the answer is no, because they don't give you enough coverage. We don't have the system of rules in place. So we said, well, what else can we do? And we said, well, it's really all about where the money goes. Securities law, banking law, insurance law, pensions law, all of these areas of law that have to do with the movement of money. We said, okay, let's pick experts in that. And now we have a team of experts in the EU, one in Asia, and one in the United States that are all expert in all of the law that has to do with the flow of money. We can find within the system, you know, that you have duties to your shareholders, to the future, for example, to future shareholders of pension funds, to their youngest members, a woman who may be 22 and just joined up and to the pension fund. Well, what's her pension going to look like when she's 70? Mm. It's not going to be very good if you're only invested in oil and gas. So for me, that's a new and exciting way of using law to approach saving the world.
If people want to know more, where should they go? What they need? You have, and it would be remiss of you not to plug your book. So Nature My Teacher, which is out imminently, I think next month, April.
I hope Nature My Teacher does lead to to a series of public talks and perhaps using my Zen priest background, meditations on nature and public meditations. I'm thinking, how do I develop that again? In the old days before Klein Earth, I did lead meditation workshops and so on. But I have a lot more experience of where the world is going and much more experience myself. So I'd like to get back to being with people in that contemplative space of exploring your own power to do good things.
Last question. If we had to edit this entire conversation down to a minute, would there be one message that you would want to broadcast? And if so, what would that be?
Okay, the 1 minute would be pick up Nature My Teacher, the book, and let that inspire you. Let it be your friend, because this is all about making friends with yourself and with nature in order to be empowered to save the world.
Wonderful. James, what a joy. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me on New Frontiers. For more stories and insights, you can visit my website, bensaunders.com. And please don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. I want to leave you with a thought from Norwegian explorer Fridtjof Nansen, who wrote this in 1928. It is a difficult time you are living in, no doubt. And the world does not give you a bright outlook just now, perhaps. But it is an interesting time. Many important things are happening, and it is full of great problems for you to solve. It is you who have to create the future and make the world a better place to live in.